You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 326.
On today's show, we're heading to Egypt for three stories that span thousands of years. Starting with a mysterious structure detected beneath the ancient city of Per Wajet, then a newly discovered royal tomb linked to Pharaoh Thutmose II near the Valley of the Kings, and finally the remains of one of the largest Coptic monasteries ever found.
All right, let's dig a little deeper, and I don't think it's aliens this time. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
All right, so we've got an all Egypt show today.
Yeah.
I was looking through articles and found a couple that were Egypt, and I was like, I bet I can find one more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, there's always amazing things coming out of Egypt, and like not just the pyramids too. It's all over the country. Ancient Egypt was huge and it spanned a huge area. So we've got some stories from different places too, which is great.
Yeah, indeed. It's not all just Cairo.
Yep.
Anyway, so this first one is from Science Alert, and it's called Mysterious Structure Found Buried Beneath an Ancient Egyptian City.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate it when they put mysterious.
I know.
It was only mysterious, you know, because they didn't know what it was. And they're like, hey, what's this?
Yeah. And like, it's just the way these articles are. You know, they're trying to hook people by like, oh, maybe it's something that's like not what it seems or whatever. But like, no, it's just, you know, there's more below the ground than we know about, obviously.
I think the next time, if there is the next time that we ever record a historic archaeological site, we should just put as the description, mysterious cans found on surface near mine.
Yeah. What could these be for?
Yeah. And so, all right. So this is in the Nile Delta in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of things in Egypt happened in the Nile Delta, not just the Delta, but around the Nile.
Yeah. I mean, it was just such a good source for agriculture at that time. So of course, tons of people lived in this area.
Yeah. And what they found was, again, what the article is calling a mysterious structure buried beneath the ruins of an ancient city. Mm-hmm. And that is not uncommon. There's lots of stuff buried in Egypt. Well, first off, people have been there for literally thousands of years. And the sand covers things. The Nile moves back and forth. And because it's in a sandy environment, it moves quite a bit. And sometimes the Nile is 10 miles away. Sometimes the Nile's right there. Right. Yeah. So, you know, things get out of favor, I guess I should say, cities and things like that, because it's no longer feasible to live there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. The one thing that you have to remember as a modern archaeologist is that what you're looking at right now today is not necessarily what the landscape looked like 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, or however long it was. And you have to try to use various different types of science, basically, to get an idea of what it looked like. Like you studied it in grad school, like the fluvial
geomorphology.
Yeah, that's like rivers,
just
right?
Studying rivers, yeah.
Yeah, just studying rivers and where they were in the past compared with today. So that kind of stuff is just so important to understanding where people lived in the past.
Yeah, the softer the banks of a river, basically the more loose it is, I guess, the more a river is going to move. And that's, you know, a river basically works like an airplane wing, to be honest with you, with fluvial mechanics, they call it, which is how water flows.
Yeah.
If you've got a lot of friction, which means a lot of materials kind of coming off of the bank of a river, that's eventually going to cause a curve. Mm-hmm. And that curve turns into kind of a big old loop.
Like an oxbow, right?
And well, it turns into an oxbow. Uh-huh. And then you get oxbow lakes when the river carves its path straight through again.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll do that because of flooding, because it'll take the shortest path.
Yep.
And then, you know, then you end up with a blocking off of this oxbow, and then it becomes an oxbow lake, or it just becomes something you can see from an airplane.
So. Yeah, there are some places that you can really see this well when you just look at the satellite image, because you can see the remnants of these oxbows and oxbow lakes.
Like flying over the Midwest of the United States.
Yeah, you can really see it. It's so cool looking. So
anyway, the ruins here are called Tel El Fararin, and which is Arabic for Hill of the Pharaohs. And this city has had multiple names across 6,000 years of existence.
Of course it did. I mean, 6,000 years is so long. Yeah. Of course it did, right?
Yeah.
The ancient Egyptian name is Per Wajet. And the reason it was called that is because it was sacred to the snake goddess, Wajet.
Yeah. Buto is the name used during ancient Greek occupation of Egypt, beginning around 305 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And then the current name, Tel El Farerin, is what it became after that.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's talk about the city as a whole and its sort of history. The city structures were repeatedly built, destroyed, and rebuilt across its long occupation, as one would expect. I mean, many, many generations have been here and probably been forgotten and then rediscovered and then, you know, just all kinds of stuff. So,
well, and clearly different peoples. Like, you've got ancient Egyptians, but then you also have the ancient Greeks who used this area. And then, of course, today there's people that live there. So at least three major groups of people, but probably more, probably many more smaller groups over time.
Yeah, it finally fell into ruin around 7th century CE. So not really that long ago in the grand scheme of things.
No, not too long.
I mean, still a couple of thousand years almost.
Yeah, but in this time, in this area of the world, when you've got thousands and thousands of years of occupation, like, well, that wasn't that long ago.
About 1300 years.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So one of the things that makes the archaeology challenging, well, a few things, is that the site has many layers of material from different occupations. Mm-hmm. That always makes for a cluttered sort of picture of what you're looking at.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And another thing that makes this difficult is mud deposits and groundwater. So, again, this is in the Nile Delta. Mm-hmm. There's lots of deposition from the Nile. There's there's groundwater that's accessible. You know, we've worked in places where we had to have pumps running pretty much all the time just to excavate.
I mean, just think about that stratigraphy, right? Like, you've got mud getting deposited by the water moving around on the surface at various times because of flooding or rains or whatever the natural water processes are. But you also have groundwater disturbance, which is seeping up from below. Mm-hmm. So you've got like natural disturbances from top and bottom having an effect on the stratigraphy of this site. So I'm sure it's just crazy complicated to deconstruct what you're looking at.
Yeah, for sure. So because of these reasons, they went to remote sensing techniques in order to sort of see what's going on here.
Yeah.
Some of the techniques they used were satellite radar and electrical resistivity tomography, or ERT.
Yeah, that one is new to me. I hadn't heard of anybody using this. I don't know if you know how it works.
I've used it.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
How have you used it?
Well, I mean, adding the tomography is just kind of a mapping thing.
Oh.
But electrical resistivity, we did, well, when I did a shallow geophysics class in grad school, we did.
Oh, the graveyard?
Yeah, we did the graveyard. But we did all kinds of different techniques. And one of those was electrical resistivity. You can make one of these machines with basically a PVC pipe and some detectors, really.
Okay.
But, and it doesn't work in certain environments. I can't remember what those were, but I think it was very dry environments it doesn't work in very well. Yeah, so I could be wrong on that. But either way, this is a method that helps detect subsurface features by measuring differences in electrical resistance.
Okay, very cool.
The team was led by archaeologist Mohammed Adurab of Kafr el-Sheikh University in Egypt. The scans revealed indications of a mysterious structure beneath the city ruins, raising the question, where exactly is it and what is it? So there isn't a whole lot more in this article, to be honest with you. They have to do more ground truthing, which means digging. But what they can tell is that there is some kind of a buried structure. There's something beneath this, and that's really not that much of a surprise. But the nice thing about this is, and this is more of an archaeotech sort of lesson, is rather than just digging a bunch of holes, which is expensive and time consuming and destructive naturally, you can use these methods to say, well, now we know where to dig. So now they can put together a research proposal, come back and say, this is where we're going to go because we know we found something here. And you got to take a look at the pictures, too, because there's some pretty good pictures in the article.
Yeah, it sounds like they have actually started to do some of the excavations to confirm what the scans have detected. They found that the structure is around 2,600 years old, which dates it to the Saite period, which is the 26th and final dynasty of ancient Egypt. So, you know, old, but not the oldest of the ancient Egypt times, you know. They also found these mud brick walls and a collection of amulets, which all date to that time period. So they know they've got a pretty good occupation from this final dynasty in ancient Egypt, which is super cool.
Yeah, indeed.
And it looks like that's also how they figured out that the occupation of this city was dedicated to the goddess Wajit of Buto because of the amulets and things that they found in this when they were doing these excavations. So all these spiritual artifacts mean that there might have been some kind of religious purpose maybe going on with these walls. But of course, they have to do more excavations to really find out exactly what this building was used for. And I'm sure as they excavate too, they'll find more structures and more things around it while they fill in the picture of this like last dynasty of ancient Egypt here.
The biggest takeaway on this article is the combining of geophysical measurements, so satellite data from remote sensing data, which is really boots on the ground remote sensing data, and creating an accurate vision of what's below the surface without actually digging.
Yeah, exactly. So. That's the genius of these. Like you said, it's like you can't just like put your shovel in the ground and hope for the best. I mean, you can, and that's what people did in the past. But now we have all these amazing techniques to help us really hone in on where to look. Mm-hmm. And this is just one really great example of them using this technology to help, you know, focus where they're doing their excavations. It's really cool.
All right. Well, we're done with that one. We're going to move on and stay in Egypt, but we're going to talk about somebody who can be taken off the missing persons list back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 326 of the Archaeology Show. And now we're going to go to another article here, and it's from, I don't know, they're not very popular, but it's National Geographic.
Oh, you know, that little publication. Have you ever heard of it?
Whatever.
National Geographic.
They don't even put their name on their cells anymore. There's a big yellow square. Like, we're supposed to know what that is. Anyway, the article is called A Dynasty's Last Missing Tomb is Discovered. And, you know, just to get it out there, it's the long missing royal burial of Pharaoh Thutmose II, described as the first royal crypt discovered in recent years.
I will say Nat Geo is a little behind the times on this one because it was actually discovered about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And Stephanie from A Past Macabre covered it in depth on her show. And you and I actually briefly covered it in just one of our segments when it was first revealed that they found it too. But I guess what they're doing here is they're just kind of following up on that story, like checking in to see what the researchers have found that can keep adding to the picture. But
there's a big difference in just reporting something that was found and waiting until they really have time to research it, study it, put out papers, and then write a decent, well thought out article.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is kind of a long article. It's a big one. There's a lot of stuff in it. We're not going to cover all of it, of course, but
there's a lot here. They're trying to give broader context to who this pharaoh was and what he meant to this area, I think.
Yeah. And they're talking about, again, it's kind of a little bit of a tech article as well. Mm-hmm. They're talking about the tools they have to analyze the tomb and what's inside of it. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So where is this thing? It's in the broader Valley of the Kings area, part of the massive necropolis along the Nile. You've probably heard of the Valley of the Kings. If you haven't, I mean, look it up. There's literally everybody's buried there.
And something I always forget about this is that Valley of the Kings is like way south of Cairo and not near the Great Pyramids at all because it's way down south.
Yeah. They didn't want to be buried next to the plebes.
I guess not.
The necropolis also includes the mortuary temple of
Hatshepsut.
Hatshepsut
is one of the more famous queens. Do you call them queens?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Queens in Egypt because she ended up ruling in place of, I'm not sure if it was her son or her nephew or who it was, but she actually ended up being a key ruler in ancient Egypt. So,
and his half sister.
I know. So there's like some Lannister level of.
Oh, the Egyptians.
The Egyptians were the first Lannisters.
They invented the Game of Thrones.
They did. Yeah. So she was his wife and also his half sister, which is just, not good for the royal bloodline, but that's what they did.
Yeah. So this tomb was discovered about a mile west of the Valley of the Kings. Within this necropolis still, though, it's huge. This necropolis is gigantic.
Yes, it's huge. There's so many tombs there.
Yep. When they stepped inside, they saw classic royal markers like inscriptions on the ceiling, traces of a celestial mural painted thousands of years ago, which I thought was really cool. If you read into the article, it literally has like blue paint and stars.
Yeah, you can see it. It's like it's almost a little bit like a little kid's bedroom.
Yeah,
kind of. But like you can see what they were going for, right? Like this is a dark tomb where they bury somebody super important, and they wanted the ceiling of the tomb to represent the sky outside, the place that they no longer were a part of. But they, created this image of it in the tomb. It's really kind of beautiful when you think of it like that.
So this discovery was uncovered by a joint British and Egyptian team, the New Kingdom Research Foundation, and announced early in 2025, as Rachel said, by Egypt's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities.
And this, I mean, obviously it's super important to find a tomb. So intact is not quite the right word, and we'll get into that in a minute, but untouched, I guess you could say.
Well, I don't know about that either.
Yeah. I mean, again, it went through some stuff, but
yeah.
They're saying that this find could change the modern understanding of ancient Egypt at this critical time in the 15th century BCE.
Yeah. This also highlights how Egyptology has changed since the early days of the 19th and 20th centuries, implying a shift toward more scientific or tech-enabled approaches versus early eras, just because of the methodologies that they used.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of reasons why they were able to pinpoint this tomb as belonging to Thutmose II. And I mean, basically it comes down to inscriptions and the iconography. All those things either had his name on them or they were symbols or things that represented him on both the artifacts and also the murals. So there's a lot of things pointing towards this tomb being for him. So
yeah,
that's how I can say that.
There's the remains of an alabaster vessel.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, the one thing I learned about Egyptology, like well over a decade ago, probably in school or something like that, was about a cartouche. And the cartouche is the sort of oblong circle, oval, if you will, with sort of a base on it. That always represents a pharaoh or a king.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the symbols inside of that are nearly always the same.
Yeah.
There could be some variations, but it represents the name of the pharaoh that was, you know, belonged to this or at least be talked about or whatever. And it's just a huge hallmark of, you know, you find this and you know, well, that person already lived at least up until this point so they could be talked about. Does that mean they're talking about somebody ancient to them, or does that mean they're talking about somebody current? And they found enough of this within here, and because of where it was found, it's unlikely they would have named any other pharaohs within this burial other than the one that was buried here.
Yeah, exactly. So. And now this tomb was not in perfect shape. And like we said, the ceiling was falling down and there were other things going on that were not good. And also there was no actual remains of a pharaoh here. And a lot of the grave goods were gone.
Yeah,
looted. It actually hadn't been looted.
Well, it was moved.
Because it was moved.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So like not long after Thutmose II was laid to rest here, the tomb was flooding and they had to move it. So they moved him to a different tomb somewhere far enough away to not be flooded anymore. And all his grave goods and everything went with him. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that tomb that he was in was eventually looted. And researchers actually do have his remains, his mummy. So we have him. We know where he is or where he was eventually laid to rest permanently. It was just this was the original tomb that they had to move him out of when, you know, flooding happened, because it's the Nile, obviously flooding. Right.
Yeah.
But what it did do, and this is the cool part about this, is because they couldn't use this tomb anymore, it was flooded. It gives us this like kind of untouched place where everything else is still intact. All the murals, all the things that they couldn't move with the pharaoh when they moved him, all that stuff was still there and intact except for the flooding that happened. So in that way, it's a really great way to learn about the construction of these tombs and what they look like and how they were used and that kind of thing. So it's a cool learning opportunity that you don't get very often in archaeology.
Yeah, that's true. And a couple of the scientific techniques that they used discussed in the article include X-ray tomography, which again is a mapping technique using X-rays, and ancient DNA analysis, which can be applied to Egyptian mummies and artifacts in some cases.
Okay.
So using these and other techniques, they really have been able to tell a lot about this.
Yeah.
A lot about this tomb, and even though the ceiling caved in.
Yeah.
But aside from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super cool. I think it's a really neat and different learning opportunity, which you don't get a lot of that in a place like this that is so heavily studied, you know? So having this be like both intact and not intact at the same time is just a really different and interesting learning opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of things getting destroyed in Egypt, we're going to talk about Christians next in segment 3. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 326. And I'm not going to say that the article sources that we have is a popularity contest.
Oh, God.
But if it were,
why?
These next ones would win because they are popular. And anybody who knows this show knows what I'm talking about.
Oh, my God.
All right. So this one's from...
So annoying.
The Popular Mechanics.
Oh.
And it's... it's
titled, I hate everything about what you just said.
Archaeologists discovered the remains of one of the largest Christian monasteries ever. And I saw this, and I actually read it, because I just read a lot of articles. And this is... the third one I dropped in here because it's actually Egypt.
I know. When you said that we had a Egypt theme, I was like, wait a minute, that last article is about Christianity. How is that related to Egypt? But, you know.
Because they went everywhere.
They did. They definitely did. Yes. So, yeah.
So, all right. Well, archaeologists found the remains of a major Coptic, and that's basically just kind of like a time frame, really.
And it's like early, right? That's early Christianity. Yeah.
A Coptic monastic complex described as one of the largest Christian monasteries ever. And now the second largest known monastic complex in Christian history.
That is crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just tells me we haven't really found them all, because how could the biggest one ever be here? Or the second largest, I guess, complex.
And it might just be that other ones that were bigger were converted into other things over the years, and they just don't look the way they did they were as big as they were, you know?
That is something to remember, though. Like, when they make statements like this, you can't assume everything's been found. It means of the things that have been found, this has these attributes, right? It doesn't mean it's literally the biggest. It means it's the biggest that's been found.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So anyway, it was discovered at the Al-Kalai, I don't know if I'm saying that right, Kalai archaeological site in Egypt.
Yep.
And there's a little bit of a historical context we can give on Christianity into Egypt.
Yeah, because that was super interesting to me, because I just didn't realize that there was that much Christian history in Egypt, but Egypt did begin transitioning to Christianity shortly after the turn of the first century CE. And by the 5th century CE, Egypt had become kind of a hub for this Coptic, again, that's the time period for Christianity, this Coptic art and culture for the area. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, kind of surprising.
Yeah, when you think of Egypt, you often think of just, you know, pharaohs and the icons of the pharaohs, like the Sphinx, you know, Tutankhamun, pyramids, things like that. But this discovery highlights what came after the last pharaonic dynasties. And it's basically, you know, a new era of changing religious beliefs away from the gods that they had in Egypt.
And I imagine that this was influenced by people coming from Europe to Egypt, right? Bringing it with them, I would imagine, since that's kind of where Christianity grew out of.
Yeah.
And then it's before the rise of Islam, too, because we don't really have a, or is there, I wonder if there's a simultaneous Muslim presence here at the same time, or
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Very interesting. This time period, this transition time in Egypt is very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a generation of monks once lived at the monastic complex. Mm-hmm. By the 5th century, it wasn't just a religious site. It was also a cultural hub of Coptic art and culture, as we've mentioned. So it was around for hundreds of years, the site was, or at least lived in.
Yeah. And what they found is both artifacts and architecture, and some of the architectural remains included columns plus the foundations for those columns. And there's the columns were part of a receiving hall for guests, which, you know, would suggest that there was people maybe taking pilgrimages there, you know, visitors coming for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a pretty well-established structure to have that kind of a remains left.
Yeah, they also found pottery vessels and fragments, including a limestone cross and a number of other vessel fragments and things like that.
Yeah, for
pretty
sure.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So in addition to that material culture, they also have some really great examples of Coptic art, and that includes walls that are covered in murals of monks. And then those images are framed by like intricate braided patterns that are in red, black, and white shades. Of course, those have faded over time. But so you have that. And then also there's like natural world images too. There's gazelles that are surrounded by foliage, flowers, and all kinds of other things. Yeah. So it's interesting to see this Coptic art also represented at the site.
Yeah, an interesting thing the article mentions too, it says, I'm just going to read a passage here. Another mission from the council previously came upon an older architectural complex from the period when Egypt segued from paganism to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what do we call it, paganism?
Like, well, paganism is...
paganism often refers to just like a worship of the natural land and things like that. And I wouldn't call having a sun god and things like that paganism necessarily. You know, it was the Egyptian gods. I mean,
yeah, but there's also that like sort of Greek Roman time period where like like ancient Egypt had sort of I don't want to say collapse, but it was just not what it was anymore. And then we had the Greek and Roman influence. And so you probably had sort of a mixture of all kinds of different religious observations going on in that time period. Mm-hmm. And then Christianity came in to fill in a void up until a certain point. And then now, of course, we know today that it's a predominantly Muslim country. So, you know, it transitioned through to that probably later in the, I'm guessing the 8, 9, 10, somewhere in that time period. So. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, they're going to find a lot more about this, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still pretty interesting seeing the transition period like this.
Yeah.
And really, I just can't believe it was just after the first century CE. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people alive that were probably alive, you know, if he existed when Jesus was alive, right? Mm-hmm. If they were old enough. And yet still, these kinds of things being established in Egypt not long after.
Yeah, it says that this actual site dates back to the 5th century. So I think that this particular site dates to the 5th century, but there's evidence that maybe there was early Christianity back to the 1st century, possibly. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, yeah, still mm-hmm. kind of amazing. Yeah,
yeah, it is. It's crazy.
Anyway. All right. Well, that's it for our Egyptian expose.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back next time with more articles.
Yep. Or maybe we'll do a stratigraphy episode, a strat chat. I do still want to do one. So
you never know.
You never know.
You really don't.
You don't.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.